talked about them. Genesis 6, the sons of God and the daughters of man. There were a number of reasons that I gave to take it as sons of God being the godly line. First of all, sons of God in itself, as an isolated term, could well go either way. Okay, just by the use of that type of terminology in the Old Testament. However, the fact that Christ says the angels do not marry is a strong reason to stop and consider it right off the bat. The idea of taking a wife in the legitimate sense wouldn't really fit angels violating a station to take them. And that would be more in the area of illicit sexual affairs, which doesn't seem to be the meaning connotated by the Hebrew phrase to take a wife. And we've seen that the injunction against mixed marriages is very strong in the Old Testament. And the problem with mixed marriages is that when one of God's people marries another, he marries one of a foreign god. If he's a man, he marries a daughter of a foreign god. If she's a woman, she marries the son of a foreign god. And because of that, it brings the strongest pull on human life against the devotion to God. Ross, do you have a question?
Yeah, there was a question I never asked yesterday about the sons of God. Every time when I read over this section, referring to that term there, I had thought that it was just the Hebrew men who had...
Okay, now the problem with that is there are no Hebrew men at this time. Okay, that's really the core of the problem. We don't really develop a Hebrew people until we have Abraham and his descendants, although the word Hebrew itself may go back to the guy named Eber, which are the same consonants. But as far as a Hebrew people, they're non-existent at this time, and that would be the...
Well, I thought that they were the men of the time in which, and no reason why it was said sons of God, it's to indicate their relationship to God.
Well, that would fit the godly line. But at this point, God's plan of redemption for mankind is wide open. He hasn't yet narrowed it down. He's going to narrow it down, and he's going to pick out one man. As the people of the whole world turn against him, really two major times, before the flood, where almost the godly line is all but wiped out, with the exception of Noah. And then even following the flood, when we see that sin is back in strength, and God's command is to be fruitful and multiply across the face of the earth, the first thing that man does is gather together and say, we don't want to be scattered, we want to be broken up, and build a city and a tower. Okay, again, the opposition to God. And then it's after that that God picks out one man and he starts to work his promises towards the promise that was initially given in just a faint light in Genesis 3, verse 15.
So in that, God is not actually claiming any particular people as his own particular son.
No, he's not doing it through a race or through a family at this particular point.
Yeah, but I'm just talking in general, the whole, all men of the time.
There is a distinction between the godly line and the ungodly line. That verse makes it clear. But it's not done on the basis of a family. It's not done on the basis of a race or anything like that, or descendants of. Okay? Okay, and there were...
The descendants of Seth?
No. Yes, the godly line tends to be the descendants of Seth, but it just says then man began to call upon God, and doesn't say just then the descendants of Seth did. Mm-hmm. So although it tends to follow one line, it isn't limited to one line. Okay, yesterday I mentioned that the ark was rather a large vessel, particularly in its time. This is the Erdman's Handbook of the Bible, which as I've been reading through, I'd recommend to you if you're interested in the handbook. Okay, in the picture you get an idea of the size there. The ark is the top one. The second one is the Mayflower. The third's a clipper ship, Cuddy's Ark. And the last one is an Atlantic liner.
big ship.
So it's a pretty good-sized ship. And for its time, it's a huge ship. Okay? I say the tonnage was probably about 43,000 tons displacement. Now that's a pretty good sized ship with a floor area of approximately 20 basketball courts, which is no small space. And if you don't need any place for machinery or propulsion, which they didn't need, all that is reserved for animals and food. Now, did it mean that Abraham brought every species that we know today on the ark? No, it doesn't. All it requires is that he had the head of the line that could provide different species. So you wouldn't find a dachshund, a Dalmatian, or that. You would find the dog that was able to be bred and brought in all these species following. Okay? Ross?
I was just thinking, I could sure see how those people at the time were chuckling at him, because he was a long ways from navigable waters and building this great big monster ocean liner out there in the yard.
Yes, somebody building something out here in Kansas.
You can see where faith without works is dead right out of that passage too. You look up in the sky, it's just as blue as can be, you keep building the boat. David.
One show, the search of Noah's Ark, they did a scientific research on the portions of this thing. They put in a wave tunnel and stuff like that and found it was very seaworthy. And they went back in the records and all towards the turn of the century or something, the U.S. built a battleship on the same sort of ratio, 6-1 to...
Yeah, it's 6-1, length versus the beam.
It's just a very stable craft. That part of 200-foot waves.
Couldn't capsize it. And of course, there were three decks on the thing. And being instructed by God, I'm sure Noah put the heavier animals at the lower level. Which those of you who have studied anything about ships know that that gives you a lower metacentric height. And the chances of tipping it then become very remote. Okay.
Doug, have you seen that picture? It's a documentary on Noah's Ark.
I haven't seen it.
Well, it was good. but it was reviewed here as if it was supposed to be a piece of fiction, which is no way to review a documentary picture. What amazes me is we got a documentary picture like that on the screen or above the screen. Mm-hmm. I thought it was tremendous.
Okay. I have to keep a lookout for that one. Yeah. I'd like to make a couple more comments. When we got to the creation account, I picked out the one that a lot of critical scholars say Genesis account derived from. And we found that although there were some similarities, man was created, the earth was created, sun, moon, and stars were created, stuff like that, the divergences were very strong. In one, you have a polytheistic society, and in the process, one god gets all hacked up and the parts become the creation. Okay? Which is 180 out from the Genesis account, which is strictly monotheistic. And even the critical scholars, as S.R. Driver, would say it's very obvious that he didn't directly borrow it at all. It would be unthinkable, in his words. Well, we have the same type of thing with the flood account. And some of you have probably heard the name Gilgamesh. Have you heard that in college? As being very similar, quote unquote. The story of Gilgamesh is a fellow that has a real close friend of his. They're not regular people like you and I. They're sort of half gods. Okay? Very valiant, heroic type people.
Were those demigods?
Well, Gilgamesh's friend, I think Endicu or whatever, dies. And Gilgamesh sees him die. And from that point on, he becomes totally preoccupied with death. Okay? He doesn't want to go through the same thing he saw his beloved friend go through. So he makes a very long search and finally gets to this fellow who endured a flood. And by enduring the flood and by the help of the gods, he was granted immortality. And that's what Gilgamesh is seeking. So it's the purpose of the flood story is not the account why God destroyed the earth at all. That's how one man strove for immortality. Now the other thing to note is that the construction of the ark is completely different. I'm reading from documents from Old Testament times by D. Winton Thomas, which records good sections of these epics. He says this: on the fifth day I erected her framework. 1 ecu in area was her flooring. 10 times 12 cubits were the uprights of her walls, and 10 times 12 cubits was the measure of each edge of her top. I filled in the shape of her sides and did join her together. 6 decks I laid into her. Did thus sevenfold divide her. Cut her beam again, ninefold. I drave water plugs into her. Chose up quant poles and laid by what was needed. By this, if you listen carefully, you found out the shape of the ark. There are, is a cube. If any of you tossed a cube into the water, it is not very stable. As a matter of fact, it's very unstable. The only way to get it, I think, to be seaworthy at all would be to put an extremely heavy ballast right in the bottom. But this place was designed so that the weight would be rather spread out. Notice in Noah's ark there were 3 decks. Okay? But in here there were 6 divisions making 7. Now the result of that is that you have a uniform, much more uniform spread of weight. What does that mean? That means the center of gravity is a lot higher, and it makes it a whole lot more unseaworthy. Okay, so they can compare that and say, well, they're very much related. Sometime if you get the chance, it wouldn't be bad just to read it and compare it and realize how neat the scripture is, because of his night and day difference. Cool. Having done that, I want to deal with another problem. Was the flood universal, or was it a limited area? Okay, why does the question even come up? The Hebrew word for land, or earth, is eretz. And it can mean just land, locally, the area, and it can mean the whole inhabited area. It depends how it's used in context. But the word itself could refer to either. Okay, so then context is going to decide whether this is a local flood that he's talking about or a universal flood. Okay, now what have we read so far that would make you think one way or another?
Read so far?
Mm-hmm.
That just the whole world. You know, it says, I will blot out the man. Well, maybe not.
So the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence.
Okay, notice that the word earth there in each case is eretz, and could be the land. Mm. I'm going to make you think a little bit rather than just telling you.
It's the whole earth, because he says all the flesh had corrupted the whole earth, you see.
Okay, there again, eretz is land, but let's keep going.
It says, everything that is on the earth shall die.
I shall destroy them with the earth.
Okay, there again, the word earth is land. I'm going to keep pressing you until you...
Face and ground.
Okay, that may...
The same word again.
Okay, the word ground isn't the same word, although it could still be used in a localized context. The word for ground or dry earth is usually adama.
When he says everything that is on the earth shall die, well, that includes not just animals, because he's got lots of vegetation.
Verse 19.
Okay. What's in 19?
And the water prevailed more and more upon the earth, so that all the high mountains everywhere under the heavens were covered.
Okay. So if high mountains are covered, how is the rest of the earth going to get by? Since there's a famous principle that water seeks its own level. Okay?
How about in verse 7?
That's one point.
To destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven.
Okay? So under heaven expands it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
7:17.
Okay, now what else might suggest that? Suppose it is a limited area. You think you need to bring in all the animals?
No, because they'd be surviving.
They're surviving elsewhere.
Yeah.
There's no reason why they can't come in and replenish the earth again. Okay, notice also in chapter 7, verse 11, it says, the fountains of the great deep burst open. We're not talking about a river flood. I don't know that the word great deep ever applies to a river. But it's been the same word that was in the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the deep. It's the same word here, to home.
You know, a thing that's always thought about on the fringe would be at a point of taking in the water animals.
No.
Because they're still there.
That's right. Although there'd be some provision by God to control the change of salinity.
Yeah.
Okay. There are several indications, at least as I see it, that the flood is of larger proportions than the area. And what we're talking about the area, the Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia means middle of rivers. Here's the one river here, the River Euphrates. And then up here, the Tigris comes in here. There it is, Tigris. This whole area, middle rivers, Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia rivers. So it's the middle river land. And there were floods in that area. Okay. But to explain all the other things and the idea of a local flood is pretty hard. Now, how long did this flood last? Any of you who read it?
A little
over a year. Now, that's a long time. For a river flood, that is a terrible long time.
How do we know it is 120 years from the time God asked Noah to build the ark into a flood?
Well, we don't know that, but we do know from the time he said that his days will be 120 years after he said he wouldn't strive with him forever. But there was a 120-year respite before God's judgment. Now, you don't know that the self-same day that he appeared to Noah, but you know there was a 120-year gap. I take that not to refer to lifetime. It's sort of silly to apply it to a lifetime when the flood's going to change it, everything anyway. Although it's a possibility from the
text. In terms of lifespan.
Yeah. And the context, I think in 1 Peter, when God's patience grew long before the flood, indicates that he felt that 120 years was the delay until the judgment. So I suspect that's confirmation. Okay, there are a number of indications. Now, what are the problems with the idea of a universal flood? Well, there's not a universal flood layer known to man. In his excavations, he's not found one universal flood layer that could be the flood. In some of the early handbooks, Bible handbooks, I think even in Halley's, you'll find that there was initial very optimistic hope, but that was rather short-lived. Now, does that change the fact of what God did? No. The other thing that has to be answered is what would you expect to be left behind from a flood of that magnitude, and where would it be left? And was the face of the earth changed very significantly by the flood? Apparently it was. So we're not talking about a uniformitarian flood layer. Okay? We wouldn't expect to see a little uniform deposit of silt all over the earth. Particularly if the seas have deepened and mountains have been thrust up because of a change of weight on the Earth's surface, you would expect them to be rather concentrated in certain areas and there to be nothing in other areas. Is that right, you geology whizzes, Ross?
Well, this Noah's Ark, they raised this very point at the beginning of their dissertation. They said at this same time, the scriptures talks about there's also a changing of the seasons. approximately the same time. And so they went to the scientists and asked, was there, can you see evidence that this was the case? About the same time there was a flood, and was there a change in the seasons? And the scientists, from what they could find, they says yes. And they said that what this has done, if this is a true, as you, if you change the axis of a spinning, it's like a gyroscope, you change the axis, it puts a tilt in everything, and at the same time, you could, it has all these seas jump, the Atlantic Sea jump over the Pacific Ocean, and Pacific Ocean jump clear over to the Atlantic Ocean, and they could have had a big flood in the process. So they say it's possible scientifically.
Okay, that is the possible shift of poles, mm-hmm. is mentioned. Okay, so the idea is not in your mind that you expect to find a universal flood layer. As a matter of fact, when you look at the words talked about the flood receding, it sounds like there's quite a surge going on. It says the water's receding, coming to and fro. So they just didn't, it's not like pulling the cork on the bathtub and very slowly coming down, but there may be, you know, up, down, up, down, you know, heading down all the way, but nevertheless, not a uniform pull a plug on the bathtub and watch it drain. Yes.
I kind of think of the Earth as a closed system with its atmosphere and a certain amount of water within the within that closed system there. And so if there was enough water at one time to flood the whole Earth, then there probably should be enough water to flood the whole Earth now, still within that system, right? And I've heard that, like, between the North and the South Pole, there's enough ice that if it melted, like, it would just cover the city of Chicago, you know, I mean, it would just, North America would just be a few peaks here and there.
Okay, having said that, the other side says that if it's to cover all the high mountains, and this is an evangelical taking the position, if it were to cover all the high mountains, that would take 8 times more water than us on the planet today. Mm. Now, the only problem with that is it assumes that the mountains are in the same position they were during the flood.
That's right.
And it doesn't sound like that. When you talk about a flood where the fountains of the deep were broken up, you're talking about a cataclysm, a major earth-transforming event. So I don't think probably that point is as well taken as it seems to hit us. The other thing you have is, those of you who have looked at a map of the ocean floor realize that there's river canyons down there. Particularly on our east coast, being a submarine, that was important to us. It was not good to run into a mountain underwater. Captain frowned on that. But if you look at a map that goes out under the ocean, the Hudson River Canyon just keeps going for hundreds of miles past the coast. Now, does a light current, you know, when the river hits the water, it's not running with the same force anymore. It's now in a whole huge volume of water, and the speed changes drastically. And because the speed changes, so does the dirt-carrying capability. Now, is it more reasonable to believe that that was well elevated in dry land at one time and was cut and is now submerged? There's a lot of questions like that that need to be faced honestly. Okay, and where would you expect the silt? In the oceans or on the land? You know, if all the waters ended up back in the oceans, I think I would probably be looking for silt on the ocean floor rather than on the land, particularly if it moved off the land with any velocity at all. And there was a lot of water to move. Okay, so these are some of the questions that you need to face honestly. There are some difficulties. We wish a flood layer would pop up and you could show it to everybody, but it hasn't happened.
I don't wish it would pop up. It would
down. Okay, is there any other evidence that we have that a flood could be of universal proportions? One thing that is interesting is you as you look at the traditions of various religions, not only on our continent, but in other continents, there's an awful lot of them that have a flood account where the earth was destroyed and just a few made it through. And that includes Indians in this country. The Athabaskan tribe on the west coast has a flood due to rain. No lands to see, the oceans were joined. The Papago Indians had man formed out of the ground, and a flood destroyed all flesh. And the Arapaho have a major flood, but instead of birds flying out of the ark, they have little ducks diving down to find out where the bottom is. That's not saying there's a duplicate account of the Genesis account. There isn't. But there is a very strong flood tradition in many, many religions at various points in the earth, not just here.
But that really undermines this, the account here, because if God only spared 8 people, there should be no flood.
No, quite the contrary. If you're the fellows that came out of the ark, and you're Shem, Ham, or Japheth, you going to tell your children about that? Probably. Okay, is it going to matter so much to the godly, ungodly line as it does to the godly? No. You'd expect a rather rapid deterioration. As a matter of fact, if you look in Romans, the very reaction to God lets your mind keep sinking down in planes. Because they didn't glorify God as God, God gave them up to futile thinking. So you wouldn't expect a very academic transcription of the flood account. You might expect some shadowy memories in the past, which seems to be what we have.
I was starting to say, this seems to me to strengthen the fact that there really was a flood, because all these people came from the same source, all the people on the face of the earth. And traditionally, they hand down the things that are important to them. You take the Polynesians, they have this woven into their artwork, their rugs and their wall hangings and things like that. And it is a flood where everything is destroyed, just a few escape. It is not Christian. But the Nez Perces have this business. They have a big animal that they hack up, and the heart becomes the Nez Perces, and all the other parts become all the other tribes of the world. And I mean, these things are just, they're prevalent all over the world when you get into world literature.
And that really has a strength.
I think it has a strength that it really happened. I mean, it didn't happen the way that they...
Now, at the same point, my faith goes in what God has said, and not, so I'm not really looking for theology or other points to prove Scripture. I proved that when I took Christ as my Lord, as we went through the other day. But there are nice things to point out to somebody who thinks you've thrown your mind out the window when you became a Christian, which is quite the opposite tack. Peter, we just read, says you need your full mind and gear for things that are coming for you. We're not supposed to throw our minds out the window. We're supposed to be able to think logically. Okay, so all I'm saying is the evidence that we have external to Scriptures doesn't all point against the flood. As a matter of fact, there's a strong evidence for the flood. And that's all I'll say. Okay. Noah's important enough to be mentioned quite a bit in the New Testament. Just for a sample here, probably rather close to an exhaustive list. Hebrews 11:7, Noah's put in the Hall of Fame for faith. By faith, Noah being warned by God of things not seen, he didn't look up and see a big tidal wave and work furiously on putting the ark together. In reverence, prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world. There's another reason, by the way, for taking it as universal. It's the word there in Hebrews for world is cosmos. God so loved the world. And became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. In 1 Peter 3:19 through 20, we'll be into that. In which spirit, speaking of Christ alive in the spirit, also he went and made proclamation to spirits now in prison, who were disobedient when the patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah. That's where I lean on my 120 years being as the time for the judgment, as opposed to a lifespan. The patience of God kept waiting in the days of Noah during the construction of the ark, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through the water. And of course, the Lord Jesus Christ, in his dissertation on the end times, Matthew 24, "For as in these days which were before the flood," those days which were before the flood, "they were eating and drinking, they were marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So shall the coming of the Son of Man be." And that's repeated in Luke 17, 26 through 27. The world destroyed by flood is again mentioned in 2 Peter 3, 5 through 6. But it gives you a pretty good idea that the New Testament writers didn't question it at all. They saw it as a type that would be repeated as far as attitude of the people on the face of the earth. Okay, there's one question that we probably ought to consider as a group. Is it true that there was nobody else alive at that time that deserved being in the ark? Did people ever ask you that? How could God wipe out everybody else? Now, the question is, have you judged the hearts of man, or has God? The declaration here was that man was evil continually. His thoughts were only evil. All day long they were evil. Here you go against the doubting of God's judgment as opposed to a speculation on man. Okay, we're going to move on down to chapter 8, verse 20. The ark has settled out. Noah's now back on dry ground. And he and the animals and his family come out of the ark. "Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar." Notice that when he went into the ark, God had him bring extra clean animals, so he didn't destroy any species at the time. And some people haven't realized that. He took seven of the clean, probably just for this purpose. Verse 21, "And the Lord smelled the sitting aroma, and the Lord said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man." Now you'd expect it. Well, the Lord has brought the righteous one through, right? So you'd think maybe he's going to say, I'm never going to do it again to man because, well, I've got the righteous left. Or because I've exterminated all unrighteousness. But the phrase that follows is completely the opposite. "I will never again curse the ground on account of man, for the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth." In other words, we're just going to end up in flood after flood after flood after flood if I keep this up. Ross?
It says the intent of man's heart is evil from his youth. Is that sane from birth?
It's not necessarily sane from birth. For a fellow that's a young man, the term is na'er. For a youth, it's na'erim. It's taken from that same root. It doesn't mean from birth, but it does mean from young, from being very young. Okay?
That's different for each person, is it?
I'm not saying that. All I'm saying is it has to do with our childhood, but it doesn't say from birth. Okay? I'm not trying to make it easy for myself. That's the what it says. Okay. "And I will never again destroy every living thing." Well, that doesn't mean there's going to be no floods. Well, there's going to be no world flood. "I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, seed time, harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease." Now, who is that promise given to?
Himself.
Lord said it in his heart. He didn't say it to
Who ends up with the benefits of the promise? Maybe that's a better... All of mankind. Christian, non-Christian, the whole world. We're talking about a regular interchange of seasons now. Okay, chapter 9. God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Verse 2, and the fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hands they are given. Okay, there's a change here in the animal-mankind relationship, or at least it's first announced right here. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. Well, that's important too. Why? Because when we get to Israel as a nation, we'll find limits being put on the food. But it wasn't always that way. Okay? Which is another good reason for seeing that this was, that these restrictions on food were for a limited time only. Because God had given them all for food at one time. Okay? But he's going to restrict his own people and for good reasons. There's only one restriction given, that's in verse 4. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. God is at this point setting aside blood for a very special purpose. And surely I will require your life blood. From every beast I will require it. From every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. Capital punishment is not based on the effects in society or its deterrent. Capital punishment is validly established on the fact that man was created in the image of God. And when another man by intent destroys another man's life, he goes against what God has created. Okay? So it's the primary motive is not a deterrent. The primary base for capital punishment is theological. Okay, in verse 7 we have a repetition, and as for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. And you notice that he extends his covenant. 9, behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. Who are Noah's descendants? Everybody. All right. And with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, of all that comes of you from the ark. Even every beast of the earth. And I establish my covenant with you, and all flesh shall never again be cut off by the water of the flood. Neither shall there again be a flood to destroy the earth. Okay, verse 13. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a sign for the covenant. Now some people think, try and press that as the introduction of the rainbow, as if the rainbow didn't exist before. But the word in Hebrew can both mean I give and I appoint. Appoint. So you're not to see, I don't think, a major change in physical laws at this point. God says, there's a rainbow. Here's what I'm going to help bring to your mind, in my mind, as I see that. I'm never going to destroy the earth again with a flood. That's what I appointed for. Now, circumcision wasn't new either when that was given. All the Semitic tribes in that area had circumcision, but it was for a different reason. They circumcised as entering into adulthood, okay, being accepted as a man in the tribe. Not so with the children of Israel. Not so with the tribes of Israel. Okay, circumcision was given to them as a sign and was done when they were just little schnitzels, 8 days old.
Doug?
Yes.
Which word was that? Point, or is it the word set in verse 13?
It would be in verse 13. If you want the word, I'll give it to you.
Set my bow in the cloud, it shall be a sign of the covenant between me and the earth.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the same word that is I give. And you'll find that that's also used very significantly as I appoint. Okay. Okay, but notice after the flood, you'd think, all sin has been done away with. End of problem. We start with a man who is totally righteous. But what happens? Sin comes out of the ark. And God just mentioned that he wasn't going to destroy the earth because, what? Because the thoughts of man were evil from his youth. Not that all sin has been destroyed, but sin is still here. Just out of grace, we're going to give man an interchange of seasons, hot, cold, seed time, and harvest, and the whole earth will never again be destroyed by the flood. Okay, in verse 21, this is after Noah has cultivated a vineyard. Then Noah began farming and planting a vineyard, 21, and he drank of the wine and became drunk, and covered himself in his tent. Ham, the father of Cain, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. Okay, the man that was righteous becomes drunk. Now, is it just that Ham looked at his father that's so bad? I got a feeling there's more in view here. That look at verse 24. When Noah awoke from his wine, he knew what his youngest son had done to him. Because of that, I think there's more to do than just looking on his dad's being in his naked stupor. Somehow Noah knew when he woke up that something wasn't right, besides the fact he probably had a hangover. Okay. But notice the curse doesn't fall on Ham. You'd expect it to, but it falls on Ham's son. Now why is that? Do you think that the religious attitude that you have will pass on to your children? How many wives did David have? One?
None.
Two? He had several. Let's see if that multiplies with his son. How many sons did wives did his son have? Solomon.
Multiply.
Okay. Wasn't a major stumbling block in the life of David, but it was in the life of his son. He took the sin of his dad and just magnified it to became the major thing in his life. And I think probably that's what we're seeing here. Okay, let me take one more minute. I don't intend to go through chapter 10 and point out all the areas where these fellows come from. I don't think you'll remember it, and I don't think it's very meaningful. And when you get a chance sometime, if you want to look at a handbook, they'll show you where all the people settle. Erdman's has a little dot for everybody, and they have it color-coded so you know whether they came from Shem, Ham, or Japheth. The thing to remember is that Shem is the word we get for Semites. And the Semites are the ones that the Hebrew people are going to come from, and that God is going to begin working his plan. So again, we'll see the plan of the author, who will eliminate everybody else first and then hit the Semites. Okay? And when he gets down to the Semites, he eliminates all the Semites that we're not going to talk about. He gets down to Terah and then Abraham, his son. And from there, he begins to lock into the plan of redemption. Okay? So we'll begin right with Abraham. And if you happen to have some questions on the stuff in between, bring them up, and if I can answer them, I will. If not, I'll try and find the answer, and if I can't, you're stuck.
It seems like during this time up to Abraham, do you think they had some kind of systematic relationship with God? Like
before or after?
Before Abraham. Like we see Noah building an altar, so that may indicate that he knew how to do it and
that's right.
How to offer it.
And it not only started with Noah, but who brought the first sacrifices?
Who's God?
Cain and Abel. That's about as far back as you can get. Okay, so there's a recognition on man's part that sacrifices are the appropriate thing. I should mention one other thing here. After the flood here, Noah builds an altar and offers a sacrifice to God. In the Babylonian account, the gods gather around like flies when they see a sacrifice going up. And just so they've been starved so long for a sacrifice, and finally one goes up and then that just gives you the change of picture that there is from a moral, upright, one God who isn't happy that there's a sacrifice that he can lunge out on, that he's been starved all this time, or a God that repents that he made a mistake in destroying man. The problem is still going on. Man is still evil from his youth. God, just in his grace, lets man continue so that he might provide the plan of redemption that he had in his counsels before the world was founded.